Good morning, everyone, and welcome. Judge Bauer and I are pleased to be joined on the bench this morning by Judge Michael Reagan, Chief Judge Michael Reagan of the Southern District of Illinois, sitting with us today by designation. Welcome.
Thank you.
With that, we'll call the first case this morning, which is In Re Dairy Farmers of America Antitrust Litigation, case number 14-3239. Counsel.
May it please the court, Christopher Mummel for the appellant plaintiff. Good morning, Your Honors.
I wonder if you'd pull that microphone up or raise it. There's a place to raise the platform.
Oh,
underneath. Yes.
There's a button on the right.
You got to be a mechanical genius to practice law here.
There you go. Nope, hit it.
No, you're going the wrong way. Right idea,
okay,
wrong
sir.
Way.
I'll hold your stuff.
I'm a mechanical idiot because I may go down.
I'd move it closer to his mouth if I were you. That's the way.
May it please the court.
Oh.
Sorry, Judge. Christopher Lovell for the plaintiff appellant. I'll just call us plaintiffs. Appeal from summary judgment ruling in an antitrust and commodity case. Standard on summary judgment is that the plaintiffs have to point to evidence that's more consistent with agreement than independent action. Resolving the disputed issues in favor of plaintiffs and not weighing the evidence and not making credibility determinations and resolving all inferences in favor of plaintiff.
Right. What is your best evidence of concerted action?
I say the best evidence of concerted action is that after meetings between the CEOs, including a meeting on May 11th, promptly after that, Schreiber radically changed its conduct so as to rescue DFA's holding up of prices in a way that neither one could have done individually.
Well, do we know anything about this meeting other than that it was had?
Yes, we do, Your Honor.
I wouldn't hang on to the microphone if I were you because it makes noises.
Sorry, Judge, that's interfering. What we know about the May 11 meeting is that the CEOs discussed future CME prices and present CME prices. That's based on the testimony of the CEO of Schreiber and an agenda. Sorry, Judge, I keep hitting that. And an agenda of the meeting that was there. Now, the CEO of DFA could not remember the meeting, but said that his practice was, when meeting with the CEO of Schreiber, to talk about whether current cheese price levels would hold, talk about market conditions, which means whether current cheese price levels will hold. Now, at this time, the evidence shows DFA was unlawfully holding up CME cheese prices. Schreiber knew that DFA was holding up CME cheese prices, and if they followed their normal practice, they talked about whether current CME cheese prices would hold. So we know all that, Your Honor, and on the summary judgment standard, this gives way more evidence than in the other cases. This text messaging decision that just came down a couple weeks ago by Judge Posner, Judge Woods on that panel, they said that had there been meetings of the executives, specific meetings of the executives, or specific price discussions, that would have made things better. And had there been, they affirmed summary judgment. And also it was said that if there were prompt changes in conduct after the meetings, that would have made things better. Well, on May 13th, in this case, Schreiber changed its conduct to start working with DFA at the Chicago Mercantile Exchange to make it more difficult for sellers to replace cheese.
Well, that begs the question, actually. You're suggesting that there's evidence that they started working toward that mutual end, and I'm not sure that that's what the evidence suggests, because these meetings, as I understand the record, occurred quarterly for a long time because DFA was a supplier of Schreiber, as well as the two being competitors. There is an independent justification for Schreiber's activity in the market with respect to barrel cheese at this particular time. That explanation being to reduce the spread between block cheese prices and barrel cheese prices.
Judge Sykes, there's a lot of evidence on those points, and you've covered a lot of ground. Just on the first point, though, that I was saying about the change in conduct, there's actual emails from between DFA and Schreiber talking about this. DFA asked for Schreiber's floor broker name at the CME and confidential information. Schreiber provides it. They talk back and forth about doing this. And making the and the rationale for making it more difficult to for sellers to replace the cheese in part is that the sales of cheese changed the price originally. Now, when that doesn't hold the prices up, on May 21st, DFA's CEO, who had just been in the meeting with Schreiber's CEO, sends out an email and says, "I can't hold up the prices anymore. If this spread between the block and barrel cheese stays at 19 cents, and that's quoted in the record, on the very next moment, May 24th, which is Monday, but that was on Friday, Schreiber steps in and does something that's never done, totally uncharacteristic. It moves the price of the barrel cheese up 16 cents a pound, second largest increase on record. Our economist says the chances of that happening is like 0.05%. At just the moment when DFA needs the cheese to move up to rescue the price support. Why does Schreiber do that? Because there's a copious evidence, Your Honor, from Professor Jesse and others, that Schreiber's interest is not in closing the spread, although that would be nice. Their big interest is in higher prices. And we have fact after fact after fact from our economists, no rebuttal affidavit from their economists, Professor Jesse, showing that the interest is in higher prices. So now they're doing something together for the next 28 calendar days and 20 days that neither one could do on their own. You never find these facts in other cases. Now, what is it that they do? The conduct is totally unprecedented, and we put in the statistics on this. I'll just read this, Your Honor, because it's according to our economist, this is Professor Piron. This conduct is more consistent with cooperation and agreement than any competition or separate conduct. One, Schreiber fixes the barrel cheese price at $1.77 every trading day, the closing price, for 20 straight days. DFA fixes the closing price for the block cheese every day, 20 days, at $1.80 per pound. In order to do that, Schreiber had to buy 100% of the barrel cheese. In order to do that, DFA had to buy 100% of the block cheese.
Remember that Latin phrase that ends up ergo proctor hoc? That this happened first, and therefore it must have been responsible for what happened later. And that's essentially, it seems to me, what you're doing. That they met, they talked, they discussed things, and then something else happened.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's a little more than that Latin phrase. If I understand the Latin phrase, it means that you're sort of assuming that two things are related, but maybe they're not.
Yeah. I think the definition of an economist is a guy who talks about things you don't know anything about and makes it sound like it's all your fault. So,
yeah. Well, okay. In this case, you're not. Well, anyway, Your Honor, in other words, when one is holding up cheese prices unlawfully, and the CFTC brought a case against DFA. And then they have a discussion, the two CEOs, about holding up cheese prices, and then the one who's holding it up can't hold it up anymore unless it gets rescued, and Schreiber radically changes its conduct to rescue them. And the third
fact shows that there's a plot.
That's sufficient under the cases to give a reasonable inference. This is just what the text messaging case said in all the cases we cited, Your Honor. And the third thing is, Your Honor, that there was an extraordinarily high volume of, because they were pegging the price at a high level, all these sellers came in. That's why DFA couldn't do it on its own, because there was too much selling. So only by working together could they absorb all the selling. Schreiber bought 20 times as much as normally. DFA bought 11 times as much as normally. Nobody else, no other participant in the whole world bought any because they didn't want to pay the price. It's not that we get summary judgment on it. We don't have to get summary judgment. It's that there's a reasonable inference that that this Professor Pirong, the economist, showed that the statistics, I know this isn't a piece of it. Anyway, the statistics showed that there was a 0.05% chance that the price would go up that much on May 24th. Now, what is the chance, if that's going to happen, you know, statistical significance is 5%. 5/100 is like a thousandth of that or something. What is the chance that that very, very, very rare event is just going to happen just when DFA needs it to happen? It's mind-bogglingly rare. But what is the chance it will happen if there's an agreement when they had these discussions about whether cheese prices will hold? Then it's the expected outcome. So this sequence of facts, I don't have one package up. I know I've been talking for a while, Your Honor, to point to the evidence. But this sequence of facts gives rise to a reasonable inference that an agreement was made. And the agreement was to hold up cheese prices, and they acted in highly unusual, parallel fashion to do so. Now, on the so that is our best evidence to answer Your Honor's first question. And that, then, the
well, it was not. Yeah. I mean, you described this as highly unusual. It was not unusual for Schreiber to monitor the spot cheese prices and to be concerned about the spread. That's completely rational economically, based on its business, and also ordinary in the course of its business, right?
No, Your Honor. Our economists showed as follows. Between November 19, 2003 and December 1, 2003, the spread was from 17 cents to 21 cents. Schreiber bought zero. That happened at other times. In fact, all these times when the spread was high, way higher than normal, Schreiber bought zero. This is in Professor Pirong's affidavit, paragraph 75, Jesse affidavit, paragraph 50, Pirong affidavit, paragraph 74 and 20. Between October 11, 2000 and March 31, 2004, our year, Schreiber bought only 13 loads in total for 3 years. Now, during our little 20-day period, they bought 79 loads, 100% of the market. On October 1st, 2004, a little bit after this, the spread was 15 cents per pound. And Schreiber's cheese buyer said, "We're not buying cheese today." This is quoted in our reply brief. "We're not buying cheese today. We already have too much barrel cheese. What we're lacking is block cheese. By having a wider spread, people will be encouraged to make block cheese." And that was the exact, and Professor Jesse has shown, those circumstances were the exact circumstances that existed during the conspiracy period. So although Schreiber didn't have any policy to close the spread, the president of Pozniak said there was no policy. They only bought when there was a need for cheese, and Judge Dow found it's a disputed issue whether they had any need. Here's what Professor Jesse testified. They had excess barrel cheese, and they were lacking block cheese. And they'd increased their barrel cheese inventory by five times the national average, and he has other statistics, and we cite to that in the reply brief. So not only didn't they have any written policy, they didn't have a general policy, the conditions in which they had it matched their statements that this isn't the time to close the spread. Moreover, there's no emails during May 24 to June 22 saying that they're doing that to close the spread. There are a couple outside of that period, and years after the fact and after Pozniak testified, I'm saying it phonetically, his name's actually pronounced Pushnock, Mr. Pushnock, the president, but when you read it, you wouldn't know that's who it is. Years after that happened, now it's been emphasized that they're doing this to close the spread. Well, we don't have to get summary judgment that that's a lie, but the false statement, what the Judge Dow found, that the evidence was sufficient to show that there was no need. However, notwithstanding the fact that we contested 8 of the 9 facts about closing the spread and put in all this evidence that there was no written policy, no oral policy, no conduct policy, and the conditions that existed showed there was any policy they had didn't apply in those conditions, and they just did not do it in those conditions in October, Judge Dow found that it was uncontested that they were acting to do it to close this, to, you know, hold the prices up in this unusual way for 20 days to close the spread, Your Honor, and, you know, we respectfully submit that's an error. So that's our best evidence on to show an agreement, and it's our pretty much all of our best evidence to show falsity. But I touched on one point that I didn't go into, and that is Schreiber's interest in higher cheese prices. Schreiber sent out a March 15 email which the government failed to question them about. I don't know if they saw it, in which they said they wanted to, their conduct on the CME would be designed, this is Mr. Pozniak, would be designed to force Kraft to raise its prices in the stores, prices for cheese in the stores, excuse me. And Mr. Dunford, who's a sales executive, then the number two sales executive, responded and said, let's hope our customers don't find out. Let's hope the trading at the CME remains confidential. There's other documents in addition to that quote that we cite, including their profits and other documents. Professor Jesse opines that certain parts of their business, Mr. Dunford says they always make more money in the restaurant business when prices are higher. Professor Jesse opines that restaurants are highly price inelastic, so that if you have a little more cheese for your cheese, you have to pay a little bit more for your cheeseburger at the restaurant, you know, McDonald's is a customer and other customers like that, you're not going to stop buying cheese. And with the restaurant business and other types of their business, it's a pure gain to have prices higher. With the other part of the business is a grocery store business. With the grocery store business, at least when prices got to their top, there is a little loss of sales. There's more elasticity because the customer is just getting cheese at the store. Still, in the March 15 email, Schreiber wanted to force Kraft to raise prices in the store, and there are conditions in which Schreiber wants to raise prices for that, so that when we show their profits, Your Honor, the profits plummet after the prices plummet. When the prices come down, the profits come down from $28 million to $4 million. This is one of the costs of a manipulation for jointly working together to do what they couldn't have done alone in an agreement. They made more money for a while, but then profits went way down because they couldn't hold the prices up anymore. So in sum, on these two points for the antitrust claim, plaintiffs respectfully submit as follows. There was more than ample evidence that's just not present in other cases of CEO meetings, radical changes in conduct right afterwards, anti-competitive conduct, meaning artificially high prices, and a rescue in an improbable time that makes no sense statistically by chance, but it's very well explained by agreement. As to the supposed legitimate conduct explanation that Schreiber has the burden to make out under Celotex, and under the JFC case, if it's their supposed legitimate independent conduct is a pretext, that can count towards the agreement. That can tend to show agreement, not by itself. That's this court's opinion, the Seventh Circuit opinion. Not by itself, but with other evidence. And under U.S. versus Edwards and other cases by this court, Edwards versus J.D. Edwards versus Kadani, if someone puts in a false affidavit, that can be used to show proof positive of what's being denied. Not by itself, it can't show liability by itself, but it can show that. So we've put in evidence that there was omitted to say the real interest is in higher prices, and that there was offered the need for the cheese and the close the spread, which can be found to be false based on all this evidence and the expert affidavits that were not rebutted by an expert. So there's no economist saying the other thing on the other way. That's the case as to the antitrust. That's the top line of the case to the antitrust claim. I would move on to the Commodity Exchange Act claim, Your Honor, unless you had more questions or I'm not clear on something I'm saying.
No, go ahead.
Okay.
I think we get the gist of your claim.
Okay. Thank you. Can I just see how many minutes I have left? I've got 18 before rebuttal. Thank you very much. All right. So on the Commodity Exchange Act claim, Section 13 of 7 U.S.C. Section 13 prohibits manipulation of the price of a commodity. Judge Dow found that the evidence was sufficient to show that Schreiber overrode the forces of supply and demand and inflated CME barrel cheese prices and CME prices for its own benefit. And basically said that the claim that would lie here would be a claim for violation, because Judge Dow found, we say erroneously, that you couldn't have an agreement under the antitrust laws, that a claim would lie for manipulation.
You're now into your rebuttal, you know.
I'm into my rebuttal time?
No, you're into your rebuttal now. The white light is on.
Oh, okay. Well, I better stop then, Your Honor. I'll just
finish. One question before you sit down on your Commodities Act claim. That act pertains to, or at least the provision that's in play here, pertains to manipulation of the market for futures contracts. And this is spot sales, so we're not in that market.
No, it's more broad, Your Honor. Actually, it's called the Commodity Exchange Act. It's thought to be futures, but what it makes a felony actually is to manipulate the price of a commodity. Now, when you get to Section 20,
underlying the futures contract,
yes,
and the commodity underlying the futures contract.
That's exactly
the question
right.
Here
that's
is
it.
Milk.
That's exactly right. So, Your Honor, when you get to 22A, there's a private right of action. 22A is the private right of action to sue for manipulation. You can sue for manipulating the futures contract price or manipulating the price of the commodity underlying the contract. Now, Professor Jesse showed that the people who are in cheese use the milk futures to hedge, including Schreiber. We proposed facts on this, and Professor Jesse showed that the correlation between CME block and barrel cheese and the milk futures is 0.99, and moreover, that the cheese price determines 75% to 85% of the milk price, because the milk price is a formula. It's not an independent price. It gets its life from...
Well, right, but just because the USDA uses cheese prices as part of the inputs for the milk price doesn't make cheese the commodity underlying the milk future.
I think the indicia...
Seeing the connection there.
Well, the indicia... I would respectfully submit under the cases, and the purpose of the statute, the CEA, its main thing is to prevent manipulation, and the Cans versus Stotler by this court says that the private right of action is critical to the integrity of the act and protecting the marketplace. I would say that the purposes of the language commodity underlying the futures contract should be, what's the contract call for settlement, you know, which is a case from the Fifth Circuit, and what is it that could manipulate the market, and what is used to hedge? Well, cheese is used to hedge. Cheese is the best or only way to manipulate, because 75% to 85% of the price is determined by cheese in the formula. And what does the contract call for? It says that this shall settle to the Class 3 milk price, which is a formula. It's not an independent price. It's a formula determined by cheese,
right,
whey, and butter, and cheese is by far the biggest factor. So that's
the way to manipulate. But doesn't that
argument
under the Commodities Act undercut your argument on the antitrust claim about the spread not being important?
No, not at all. It doesn't relate to it at all. You know, it's not that the spread's not important. It's that the most important thing is to make the prices higher. The thing about the spread is that with supply and demand, the spread has gone from negative 15 cents to 32 cents. And it's a euphemism to say I'm correcting the spread to 3 cents, because that's actually depriving the market of information about what's the relative supply and demand for block and barrel cheese, which Shriver's witnesses admitted and Professor Jesse stated and explained with the history of the spread trading. So it's there is no policy to close the spread, and the relevance of the spread to Schreiber is maybe if Schreiber got the prices high and could keep the prices high, then also the spread should be in line, but the dominant interest is to keep the prices high. Thus, twice when DFA let the price fall, Mr. Pozniak, the president, directed Mr. Erlash, the trader, to send a broadcast email to everybody in the company. This is contemporaneous in 2004. This isn't something made up four years later. Those emails didn't say, the spread changed, we're okay, this might help the spread. They said, DFA let prices fall today. We don't know why. We'll let you know as soon as possible. Goes along with the profits and all this other evidence that shows that Schreiber's big interest was to move prices up. And under the commodity claim, just like under the antitrust claim, we're showing that Schreiber acted, as Judge Dow found, to move the prices up. If that satisfies Your Honor, I'd like to quit
to
save a little rebuttal.
Yes,
thanks,
that's
Judge.
Fine.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Nate Eimer on behalf of Defendant Schreiber. And I thought I would address the antitrust claim first, if that pleases the Court, if I may. Mr. Lovell's right. The plaintiffs here needed to come forward with evidence that tended to exclude the rationale that Schreiber's behavior was governed by his independent conduct. And we put in a substantial record, and I think Judge Dowd did an excellent job of summarizing that record, of our continuing interest in maintaining the spread at about 3 cents. That record goes back at least as far as 2000, the evidentiary record here, and Schreiber had a history going back at least until 2000 of acting to maintain the spread between block cheese and barrel cheese. The evidence is undisputed. In fact, the plaintiff's economist put in evidence that the average spread, in fact, was slightly over 3 cents during a 14-year period from 2000 to 2014. The USDA assumes that the spread will be 3 cents in figuring out the price of Class 3 milk. And so when the spread deviates from that, Schreiber winds up paying more for milk than it gets for cheese, or the other way around. It loses more for cheese than it saves on milk, depending on which way it spreads. We had a substantial interest in it. Undisputed fact was that we bought 1.2 billion pounds of milk in 2004. And a differential such as the spread opened up in May and of 2004 cost Schreiber tens of millions of dollars during that period, and that was unrefuted in the record. It was also undisputed that Schreiber, beginning in early 2004, long before this conspiracy supposedly was hatched, Schreiber tried to eliminate and tried to organize to eliminate the dual trading of barrels and blocks so that we could get rid of this concept of a spread in the CME, because the spread was at times varying and was very unfavorable to the barrel purchasers. Schreiber also submitted evidence that on June 1, supposedly in the midst of this conspiracy, Schreiber's president, Mr. Ferguson, wrote a letter to the CME, complaining about what he believed was manipulation on the CME because the spread had opened up to 19 cents. And he said very clearly in that letter on June 1, and he said he was outraged. He said, "I'm writing in reference to the trades made on the exchange on May 21st and May 24th, the very days the plaintiffs are saying that we supposedly acted unconscionably and somehow joined a conspiracy. Our president is writing to the Chicago Mercantile Exchange complaining about what happened those very days, not complaining about our conduct, but complaining about conduct of other traders who've opened up this big 19-cent spread when it should be 3 based on the cost of the materials." And he said that that 19-cent spread doesn't reflect the cost of raw materials for these two products. And I think this is a clear indication that everyone in the dairy industry, that CME is not acting as a decisive price discovery mechanism. And it would be awfully strange for our CEO, who supposedly is our lead conspirator, to be writing to the Mercantile Exchange and complaining about the conspiracy that he's supposedly engaging in. But not only does that indicate our interest in the spread and maintaining the spread at 3 cents, but our conduct does. And our conduct is quite decisive. If one wanted to look only at 2004, beginning in February of 2004, we produced emails to the court and in the record showing that we were trying to close the spread in February of 2004 and that we bid and bought on the exchange in February of 2004 to close the spread. We did it in March of 2004. There are emails from March of 2004.
Right. Your opponent contends that during the conspiracy period in May, the activity was unusually high.
It was not, Your Honor. If one goes back to the year 2000, we did exactly the same thing. In fact, we bought 138 barrels in a 20-day period to close the spread in May.
What percentage of the market did that constitute?
It was the vast percentage of the market. I don't have the exact numbers, but I don't know there was anybody even close to Schreiber at that point. Now, remember, this is an open market. That's the other thing the plaintiffs overlook here. There's nothing that keeps – there's hundreds of millions of pounds of cheese sold every year in the open market. And if the price on the CME doesn't reflect what people think it should reflect, there's nothing that keeps them from coming to the CME to reflect that. So during this period where we supposedly manipulated the market by buying, I think it was 3 million pounds, 3.2 million pounds of cheese, Schreiber off the CME bought 100 million pounds of cheese. So our trading on the CME was negligible compared to the actual amount of cheese we bought. It was a trivial amount of cheese. And not only that, because we needed the cheese, we imported 17 million pounds of cheese from Europe because we were worried about shortages of cheese in the fall of that year. And so it's far from being an anomaly. It wasn't an anomaly at all. It had happened exactly this way in 2000 when there was pressure on the market to expand the spread. We did it twice that year. In 2000, we bought 138 loads of cheese in August. And then again in September, we bought 49 loads of cheese on the CME to correct the spread. And Schreiber continued to defend itself. It really is defending itself against other forces that are pushing the spread apart or pushing it together, depending on the interests of the various parties. DFA was charged by the CFTC in this very period with manipulating the Class 3 futures market by buying on the CME. It was that caused the price, apparently, to be where it was, at least according to the CFTC and the plaintiffs. And what one sees is Schreiber trying to defend itself against the spread that was being opened up by the purchases that were being made by DFA. That was perfectly lawful for us to do that. There was nothing unlawful about it, and there was nothing that was against our business interest. The plaintiffs have consistently, in this case, tried to find some way that our conduct was against our business interest. And if one goes back and looks at the complaint, at that point they were alleging that we had a payoff from DFA, that DFA promised to sell us 5 million pounds of cheese to pay us off for entering into some conspiracy because it was against our business interest. Well, that didn't survive long, because when discovery opened up, it was clear that we bought the 5 million pounds of cheese at the market price. So then when we were in the summary judgment motion, Mr. Lovell changed the theory to, well, it wasn't 5 million pounds that was the issue, and it wasn't a payoff based on that price, but we didn't take delivery until August. And by August, the price had gone up, and the difference somehow compensated us for the losses that he says we took. Well, they also say we made money on it, we wanted to raise the price, and we took losses. They have like all sorts of shifting theories as to why this was in our against our business interests, and we had to be paid off by the DFA. But in fact, Judge Dow correctly found was, how in the world, when we bought this cheese in July, would we know that the price would go up by August? And we asked for delivery in July. And so the supposed payoff theory has been dropped in this court altogether. They haven't argued that at all now. Now they have a whole series of theories that I think are also, first of all, they don't even dispute the fact that narrowing the spread was in our interest. Professor Jesse says it was. He just says it wasn't proportionate, whatever that means. Well, I don't know what the court thinks, but to me, 1.2 billion pounds of milk sold at a disadvantaged price sounds pretty substantial to me. So their new theories are, one is that the trading activity was unusual, as Your Honor mentioned, and Judge Dow found that it wasn't unusual because the undisputed record is that the price has stagnated for long periods of time, both on the barrel market and on the block market, and he gives a pretty good summary of that on pages 31 through 33 of his opinion, that the price swings have been substantial over times, so that there are big swings in the spread. And Mr. Lovell points to the swing on May 24th when we supposedly changed our conduct, which we didn't change, but we bid up the price from $1.61, I think it was, to $1.77 that day for the barrel price. Well, the thing that he didn't tell the court was, under the CME rules, and I think it's Exhibit 41 to their brief, under the CME rules, we can't just jump the price up. So it started at $1.61, and then we bid $1.62, and nobody sold to us. We bid $1.63, and nobody sold to us. We bid $1.64 and nobody sold to us. Nobody sold until we got to $1.77. So how is that an artificial price? We actually did exactly what the CME is supposed to be. We discovered the price. The real price that day was $1.77 because no one would sell till $1.77. And then until June 22nd, we bought cheese. So long as the price was at $1.80, we bought cheese at $1.77. And relative to the market, we bought a very little amount of cheese. The 3 million pounds we bought was nothing compared to the 100 million we bought off the exchange, or that was being sold by traders and buyers off the exchange as well. And on June 23rd, they point to some unusual drop in the price. But what happened on June 23rd was the new market report came out on June 21st. It showed inventories up 6 or 7%. Prices were starting to be bid down. DFA apparently tried to maintain the price, but we did nothing. We didn't try to maintain the spread, the price level at $1.77. as the price fell, we were happy to let the price go down. And the price went down in conjunction of both together. So the spread maintained, if the court looks, after June 22nd, the spread stayed at 3 cents a pound, just as we wanted it to. Then it stayed at 3 cents a pound all the way down. And it stayed at 3 cents a pound until July, when it opened up again and we began to buy again to narrow the spread. So the trading throughout this period is consistent with our interest in maintaining the spread, and there's nothing to rebut it.
What about the meetings during the conspiracy period?
I'm happy to discuss that.
That evidence may suffer from the Proctor Hawk fallacy that Judge Bauer was referring to, but it is there.
There's no doubt. There's four meetings they point to, actually. I can focus only on the May 11th meeting if the court wishes.
The May 1st one was a Kentucky Derby party?
The first one was a Kentucky Derby party. Mr. Ferguson said that he and his wife were invited to the Kentucky Derby. He didn't go to the first day's parties. He had an emergency at one of our plants, and he went to the Derby with his wife, and he said no one talked about business that day, so I don't know that
you can skip
much
to
more
May
attention.
11th.
Yeah, so I thought I'd skip to May 11th. So May 11th is really distorted. So first, as Your Honor noted, the May 11th meeting was one of our quarterly meetings. There's evidence that we have a quarterly meeting every quarter. We buy 100 million pounds on average a year from DFA and cheese. They're a huge supplier. We're one of their largest customers. They met with us just as they met with all of their customers. There was nothing unusual about meeting with us. There is an agenda for every meeting, just as we as lawyers would advise our clients to have in a meeting. The agenda was unchanged. We produced all of the agendas. They're the same. The first item on the agenda for every one of the meetings year after year is market conditions and forecast. The testimony was they discussed market conditions and forecast generally. And now I want to talk to the parts that Mr. Lovell emphasizes in the brief and in court today, which are both inaccurate and wrong. First, they said the meeting was hastily scheduled, as though it was some usual thing, then trying to create the impression that we had to come to the rescue of DFA and they needed help, and so they called us. There's no evidence the meeting was hastily scheduled. What they point to is a change in the itinerary because a plane was chartered to fly people from Kansas City to Green Bay for the meeting. And the testimony was that normally they use their own plane to fly up to Green Bay, but for some reason their plane was occupied and they had to get a chartered plane to fly up to Green Bay. But there was no evidence that the date was arranged then. All that happened was, and the only evidence is, a change in the itinerary, which made the itinerary the chartered plane. The other piece they point to is to show that it was sudden and somehow they needed to meet to get this conspiracy going with the chartering of the plane. That testimony was totally distorted. Yes, they chartered a plane. It was what was missing in their brief was they chartered the plane because the company plane was tied up somewhere else. Then they said, well, they almost never meet at company headquarters. This meeting was at Green Bay, where Schreiber is. They always meet at trade association meetings, according to their brief. That's a complete distortion of Mr. Korsmeyer's testimony. Mr. Korsmeyer testified to the opposite, that usually they met at headquarters of each other. They'd alternate between Green Bay and Kansas City, and once in a while they would meet at a trade association meeting for the quarterly meetings, but that was not the regular practice. And now let me get to the conversations, which I think is what Your Honor is focused on both. No one testified that there was discussion at that meeting about holding prices at the CME. That wasn't testified to at all by anybody. Mr. Hanman, who testified earlier that he had had a stroke recently and was having trouble remembering details, particularly details from 10 years previously, couldn't even remember going to the meeting. And the word hold actually is used in Mr. Hanman's testimony, where he says that he would talk to Mr. Ferguson and his other customers about, you know, what the market was and what was going on and whether prices would hold. That's what he said. He wasn't referring to that meeting. He was referring generally to the conversations he would have with Mr. Ferguson when he would meet and talk about what they expect the market to do. They asked Mr. Ferguson, who did remember the meeting, what he remembered about it. And they tried several times to get him to talk about CME prices. So they asked him, do you remember any discussion about the CME cheese prices or unusual aspects of the market? He said, I don't recall anything specifically other than the forecast that we talked about. And this is forecast for supply of cheese and so forth. This is in Mr. Ferguson's testimony in 2014. And then a little later in the transcript, they tried to plant with him an improper question and assumed that he had talked about CME. So he was asked, when you talked about CME prices at the May 11, 2014 meeting, do you remember any discussion about who was transacting on the CME? And Mr. Ferguson, who listened very carefully, said, one is, I don't think I ever said we talked about CME prices. We talked about forecasts. So there was no discussion about holding price levels on the CME at that meeting. No one testified to that. There's no evidence that suggests that DFA and Triber discussed their own trading activities or intentions. In fact, everyone involved testified they didn't discuss those. So I think the May 11th meeting is nothing more than a meeting between a supplier and a customer discussing what the supplier, and this is only a one-way discussion. Mr. Ferguson testified that we never told DFA anything about what we thought the market was like. This is a supplier and a customer, with the supplier telling the customer what they think the market's going to look like, what they expect in forecasts, whether they think prices in general are going to be where they are. There was no discussion, no evidence of anyone discussing prices on the CME. If I may for a moment, I'd like to talk a little bit about our supposed lack of need for cheese. This is all great with hindsight. Dr. Jesse is talking about what he's looking at today, and he's looking at whether or not our inventories in May and June of 2004 were higher or lower than they had been in other years. But what's important to me is what was actually going on in 2004 and what people thought in 2004, and we have a very good record of what people thought in 2004. So first, in addition to the 3 million pounds that we bought on the CME, as I mentioned, we bought 110 million pounds during that very period of cheese off the CME because we needed the cheese. We bought 17 million pounds in Europe because we needed the cheese. There had been shortages all through 2004 up to that point, and prices had skyrocketed to the highest price ever for cheese. We had bid in March on the CME to try and buy cheese because we couldn't get cheese, and we were able to buy nothing. There was no cheese available in March.
Why not? What was the explanation for the shortage?
There were two explanations, Your Honor. One, mad cow disease was detected in Canada, and we closed the borders to the Canadian replacement heifers, so there was a shortage of heifers coming into the United States. And Monsanto makes a chemical or an additive. They would hate if I called it a chemical, but sorry about that, Monsanto. Monsanto makes an additive to feed that enhances milk production. And their plant in Austria was closed by the Austrian government, and so milk production plunged, and there was a weather problem as well. So milk production plunged in 2004 in the early parts of the year, and there was nothing that showed that it was going to recover. And so our inventories hit an all-time low. We were down 10 million pounds of inventory in April. In May, we were still down 5 million pounds of inventory in May. And the unrebutted testimony was that the industry, including Schreiber, expected shortages again in October and in the fall because milk production peaks during the summer and then tapers off in the fall. And so Mr. Ferguson testified that he wanted to build inventory because he was afraid it was going to be short. Mr. Herlach testified to exactly the same thing. He was our trader on the CME. Producers were buying and storing cheese, anticipating a shortage in October, is what he said. And that was exactly what we did. We bought cheese in those months throughout the summer, anticipating a shortage in October. In fact, the shortage didn't appear. Our documents indicate they would appear. There's a whole series of analysts' reports, I think. We cited Exhibits 23 and 25 to our brief, where analysts were forecasting shortages and higher prices for the rest of the year. They were saying that the $1.80 price that DFA was supporting was probably the bottom of the market, and the prices were going to go up, which gets me to my next topic, which is they argue that the prices we paid were too high. Well, that's interesting, because $1.77 actually was the lowest price that had prevailed since March 10th of 2004. It's true that later prices dropped, but that's great if you're a Monday morning quarterback. It's not so great if you're sitting there on Sunday morning playing football. At the time, our contemporaneous documents show that the price was considered to be a very good price, not a bad price. Mr. Herlach testified it was correctly and without dispute that $1.77 was 40 to 50 cents a pound lower than the price of cheese had been just a month or two before. And when he was buying cheese at $1.77 on the exchange, he thought there was nothing wrong with that price.
But there's no question there was a spike during the conspiracy period.
No, it didn't spike, actually. So the price came down to a low for one day on May 21st. That was $1.61, but it had been $1.83 or so just a few days before. Then we bid it up to $1.77 with unfilled offers or bids on May 24th, as we bid 161, 162. Then it stayed at 177 until it began to drop after the June inventory report came out from the USDA.
The spread spiked.
The spread spiked before that, yes. So the spread spiked at around 19 cents or so on May 21st. When it hit the big drop, and that's when Mr. Ferguson wrote his letter to the CME saying, this is wrong, there can't be this kind of spike, and so we narrowed it to 3 cents. So during the so-called conspiracy period, the spread is flat at 3 cents, and we maintained it at 3 cents. I mean, we've never shied away from that. We've consistently said that's what we did. Maybe I should turn to the CEA, if I may.
Sure.
So I think Your Honor hit on the key point on the CEA. The cause of action that's at play here is one for manipulating the market for Class 3 milk futures. The law is very clear that the underlying commodity is manipulation of the underlying commodity is what the issue is. The underlying commodity, courts have all said, is what's specified in the contract. The commodity specified in the contract is Class 3 milk futures. There have been a couple of other cases where people have tried to use some other reference point and say that, well, the price of the underlying commodity is somehow determined or affected by something else. This was what happened in the Hershey case, and the Court of Appeals there said no. The Hershey case was for gas futures delivered at Henry Hub rather than gas prices generally, Your Honor. The plaintiff alleged that the defendant tried to manipulate gas prices generally, and the court held no, that's not what the contract specifies. You have to manipulate Henry Hub prices, and you're not charged with doing that, and you didn't do that. So the same thing happens here. The LIBOR case is the same. It's even more extreme. In the LIBOR case, it's a manipulation of Eurodollar futures for Eurodollars. Eurodollars are priced exclusively in relation to LIBOR. The defendants there, as a lot of cases are going on, were charged with manipulating LIBOR, and the court said no, LIBOR is not the underlying commodity. The underlying commodity is what it says in the contract.
This interpretation would actually be a major expansion of the Act, the private right of action under the Act, as I understand it, to make actionable claims having to do with remote inputs into price of the commodity that underlies the contract.
Exactly, and no court has ever done that. And not only would it extend to cheese, there are actually three inputs into the formula price of milk, cheese being one, butter another, and whey powder another. So if your Honor were to do what Mr. Lovell asked you to do, you'd be actually now expanding it to three commodities being the underlying commodity, because all three factor into the formula, and all three would, in his view, affect the price. So I don't know of any court that has been willing to take that sort of a leap. And I have a little bit of time left, but I think I've closed off unless Your Honor has any further questions.
All right, thank you,
Counsel. Thank you very much.
Mr. Lovell, you've got 2 minutes left.
On the meeting, Your Honor, the first meeting was on April 28th. It was a private meeting where Mr. Hanman picked up Mr. Ferguson at the hotel, and on April 29th...
On the way to the Kentucky Derby.
No, it had nothing to do with the Kentucky Derby. It was in Kansas City where Mr. Ferguson took a plane, was picked up by Mr. Hammond. They met privately at DFA's offices and then took them back on April 29th. The May 11th meeting was arranged. Now, as to the... Sorry, Judge.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so and then the Kentucky Derby meetings come next. There's four meetings in total that have been testified to. On the May 11th meeting... this court said in Omnicare that where, not the CEOs were meeting, but where there were exchanges through the general counsels of price information, when they're both a horizontal competitor, as here, large horizontal competitors.
But also supplier.
And another relationship going on, that the court has to walk a fine line. You just don't say, oh, it's okay to exchange price information. Judge Posner said in his book, and the cases say, and there's a Todd versus Exxon case in New York that says, just a dry exchange of prices when there's a customer-supplier relationship is okay. We cited below to company compliance manuals in our fee brief that came later, where if there's a horizontal competitor relationship and a customer-supplier relationship, they said, be very careful. You can't just talk about prices. Here, it's not an exchange. It's the CEOs of the companies. So the fine line that was talked about in Omnicare is much more sensitive because there's no general counsel present. There's no one present, and they're talking about prices, and Mr. Hammond says whether prices will hold. This type of communications have been enjoined and found to be violations themselves when it's not the CEOs doing it. So on the other hand, we want to be able to promote if there's a legitimate negotiation of a contract, which hasn't been pointed to here. If there's something going on that needs they to discuss prices in order to negotiate, which wasn't pointed to, nothing specific, we want to let that happen. But to let horizontal competitors, large horizontal competitors, habitually begin their meeting talking about whether cheese prices will hold is way over the line. It's way over the line in the cases. And Judge Dow, with great respect, he's a great gentleman. He was always nice to us, and he did so much work on this opinion. Plaintiffs respectfully submit. He got this totally wrong by saying once it's a customer supplier, it ends the inquiry. No, under the law, it begins the inquiry, Your Honor. And when it's a collusion facilitating device, one's unlawfully holding up prices. Will cheese prices hold? By horizontal competitors, Mr. Scholler said, the head of Schreiber Sales said, DFA is a very vigorous competitor when it comes and gives good low prices to our customers. They are very tough. And he said, DFA always manipulates. That as the sun comes up in the east, they used to manipulate the Wisconsin Exchange, which closed in Milwaukee, Your Honor, during the 1990s.
No,
that's the testimony.
To my status as a
okay, all right.
Your time has expired, Counsel, if you'd wrap up.
In the last sentence is, Mr. Scholler said that anyone had told people, anyone who sells cheese, anyone who buys cheese from DFA is giving them an excuse to manipulate. Schreiber then entered a contract to buy the most cheese from DFA of anybody. Still, the horizontal competitor relationship was much larger, but both these companies empowered one another to do this manipulation structurally and through these conversations. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Our thanks to both counsel. The case is taken under advisement.